Welcome to the special edition of the NACE podcast series discussing tixagivimab, silgavimab, brand name, Evusheld. I'm Dr. Neil Skolnick, professor of family and community medicine in the Sidney Kimmel Medical College of Thomas Jefferson University. This is the final episode of a three-part series focusing on tixagavimab, silgavimab. In the first episode, we gave a brief overview of the dual monoclonal antibody, then discussed challenges and opportunities in identifying the right patient who might benefit. In the second installment, we talked to one of the authors of the primary study on tixagavimab, silgavimab. We talked about how it works, the clinical trial data, and provided an update on how the characteristics of the current viral variants have decreased susceptibility to being neutralized by tixagavimab, silgavimab. And in this, the third and final episode, we'll talk more about the unmet needs and the importance of layering mitigation and protection for those who are most at risk of COVID-19. This podcast series is supported by an educational grant from AstraZeneca. Joining me for today's discussion is Dr. Lena Wen, who is an emergency room physician and a professor of health policy and management, a distinguished fellow at Fitzhugh Mullen Institute for Health Workforce Equity at George Washington University School of Public Health. She previously served as Baltimore's health commissioner. She's a CNN medical analyst and a contributing columnist for the Washington Post. And in fact, recently wrote on the topic that we're going to be talking about today. Welcome, Lena.
Thank you so much, Neil. Great to join you as always.
Yeah, to start out, as much of our country has walked slowly back to normal, eating out, traveling, going to conferences, can you discuss for our listeners the reasons we should think a little more carefully about protection against COVID infection for those who are most vulnerable, particularly those who are immunosuppressed?
Yeah, I really appreciate this question. And I also appreciate the fact that we're speaking about this because it is definitely true that most of the world, or at least most of the US, seems to have moved on from COVID. We can walk around, go to the store, get on a train, go to the airport, et cetera, and see that things look a lot like they were back in 2019 and before. But there are also many individuals, millions of Americans, who are still really terrified of what could happen if they were to contract COVID. And that would include individuals who are immunocompromised. And you mentioned that I wrote a Washington Post column about this recently. I wrote about a reader who wrote to me, whose husband has chronic kidney disease and is considered immunocompromised as a result of this. And his physician has told him that if he were to contract COVID, that it could push him over, tip him over into kidney failure. There are, of course, many other people who are on chemotherapy for their cancer, who are recipients of organ transplants and are immunosuppressing medications, who have severe primary immunodeficiency, who have advanced untreated HIV, who are on active high-dose steroids for a variety of conditions, who would be considered to be moderately or severely immunocompromised, estimated to be about 7 million people in the US in this category. And the issue here is twofold. One is that these individuals are, by nature of having underlying severe conditions, they're more likely to become more severely ill if they were to contract COVID. And then secondarily, they also have the situation where the vaccines that we have may not elicit as much of an immune response in these individuals. It might, but it also may not. And again, these individuals are more susceptible anyway to more severe illness. And so I think it's an important conversation for us to have, because as much as the world has moved on and as much as we should, in fact, encourage people who are able to resume pre-pandemic activities to do so, because we also know that there are negative impacts on their mental health if there's prolonged isolation and not doing the things that we want to do. But at the same time, I think that the lesson for me here is not that COVID is over, because it's not, but rather that we should focus our energy and our attention to addressing the needs of people who are the most vulnerable. And that would specifically include this category of people who are the most, who are very vulnerable by virtue of immunocompromise.
Yeah, those are critically important points. And can you talk a little bit about the conversation that we as healthcare professionals should be having with our patients who are most vulnerable? How do we talk to them about things like layering mitigation? I know you talked about in your article. What's the conversation we should be having?
Well, I think part of the conversation is assessing each individual's risk, because as we have seen throughout COVID, there is no one size fits all. There are definitely individuals in the category that we were talking about who are really immunocompromised. I mean, patients who just had a bone marrow transplant or who are on high dose chemotherapy, et cetera. I mean, they are really at high risk. And especially if they have also CHF or COPD or diabetes, or I mean, the more risk factors, of course, the more susceptible they are. There are also individuals who may think that they are in this category of very vulnerable individuals who may not be. I mean, I've seen patients, for example, who are in their 30s and 40s with asthma, and maybe once in a while they take steroids for asthma exacerbations. Those are not individuals who are moderately or severely immunocompromised. And I think we can also have a conversation with them about how their risk is not such that they may need to take all these protective measures. But that said, I think that's the first step, is assessing that person's medical situation and how vulnerable are they, taking into account things like age, other underlying conditions, the degree of immunocompromise. And then, to your point, Neil, it is having this conversation about this layered mitigation strategy. Understanding that that risk, just as risk is cumulative, so are protection measures, in the sense that getting vaccinated, being up to date on boosters, that would be one layer of protection. If somebody recently contracted COVID and they also are up to date with their vaccines, that gives them an additional level of immune protection through hybrid immunity, which we know to be quite strong. And then having access to treatments. If individuals are eligible for Paxlovid, I would definitely have a plan for individuals for the antiviral treatments that are present, having a plan for what happens if that person contracts COVID. And then, of course, things like masking. My stance for months now, since Omicron first came to our knowledge, is that if you're going to be wearing a mask, you should be wearing the highest quality mask that you're able to tolerate. And specifically, that adults should be wearing an N95 or equivalent, N95, K95, KF94. We should make sure that it's well fitting, and consistently wearing the mask, as we all know, is very important. And so I would definitely have a conversation with my patients about the need to wear these highly protective masks, and consistently wear these masks in indoor crowded settings. And then also, if people are gathering, doing a rapid test right before gathering, not for the vulnerable individual to do a rapid test, but rather if a vulnerable individual is going to be gathering with others, having others do a rapid test right before gathering can also reduce the risk of transmission as well. And so, again, understanding that risk is cumulative is also another component, as in, I think sometimes patients will come to us asking about, well, is this activity safe to do? Can I do this activity? And we need to weigh the transmission risk of that activity, try to reduce the risk with things like masking and testing, but then also speaking to the patient about what is the benefit of that activity to them. And if it's something that's really crucial, it's that conversation about the risks versus benefits, I think, is something that we can help our patient to, depending on their individual situation.
Lena, I love discussing risk assessment and approach to risk with you, because we both share a philosophy that it's a nuanced discussion, that we can help people understand their risk, but then everyone has different tolerance for risk and different values that they attach to the activities that they're going to go through. And whenever I hear you speak about it, I always I always learn something new. We've talked about the different layers of risk mitigation. I want to pivot now to talk about our main topic for this podcast, which is tixagevimab, silgavimab. And let me review some of the original study data and then ask for you to update us on how that fits in now, given the significant change in variants really just over the last few months. So there were basically two important studies that came out that were reviewed on our second podcast wonderfully, but briefly, the pivotal study, the PROVENT study, included about 3,500 individuals, but they were not previously infected or previously immunized. And this was not a group that was at high risk. This was not all immunosuppressed individuals. They were followed for 180 days. And it turned out that the group that got the dual monoclonal antibodies had 83% efficacy in preventing any infection. And there were actually no hospitalizations in that group. There were 5 hospitalizations in the placebo group. In the second study, it was a very different study. It wasn't a randomized study. It was a matched cohort study. And this was of people at high risk, transplant recipients in the VA system. 5,400 did not receive the dual monoclonal antibody, 1,700 did. And in this study, among severely immunocompromised individuals, effectiveness was 67% against infection, but 87% against hospitalization. Now, I know things have changed, and I'll ask you to update us on that in a moment, but these really serve as proof of concept studies for when, in the context of susceptible variants, how a strategy of dual monoclonal antibodies can be effective, and for a good year about was effective in helping this group of people. Lena, with that update, realizing those studies were done quite a while ago, can you update us on the current state of the variants where things have changed enormously?
Absolutely. So we have seen throughout the pandemic that we are having this panoply of developing variants. It feels like really on a weekly basis, we're going through, we are hearing about a new variant that's becoming dominant. Every new variant seems to be more transmissible than the last, which makes sense because it is taking over from previous variants and displacing previous variants. The variants that are currently the dominant ones around the world are all offshoots of Omicron, but they are evolving in such a way that unfortunately, there is some degree of immune evasiveness, and in particular to the treatments that are developed. Right now, in terms of treatment, and we're not talking about preventive antibodies here, but in terms of treatment, there are actually no more monoclonal antibody treatments that the FDA is authorizing for treating someone once they have developed COVID, because the variants that are there have evolved in such a way that that these monoclonal antibody treatments no longer are deemed to be effective. Unfortunately, there was also news recently in early January that the monoclonal antibody that's used for preventive therapy to help to prevent people from developing COVID, Neil, as you were talking about, unfortunately, the FDA has also said that this antibody may not protect against the Omicron subvariant XBB.1.5. Now, XBB.1.5 is nearly 50% of all the new cases of COVID here in the U.S. In some parts of the country, for example, the Northeast, it is by far the majority of cases. And I think that it's quite an ominous sign. I mean, it's really not good for us to lose tools in our arsenal to protect people who are the most vulnerable. And I think this is the reason why I and so many others have been arguing that we really need to double down on having Operation Warp Speed Part 2 or some other type of really national effort in order to develop better treatments and protective mechanisms, including these types of preventive antibodies that can be given prophylactically to individuals who have moderate or severe immunocompromise.
It's a critically important thing. I know that Tixagavimab, Sulgavimab is currently, whatever the next version is, the 2.0 version is being worked on. There is a trial listed in clinicaltrials.gov about a new dual monoclonal antibody that is in the pipeline. We hope that it'll work. We hope that that data will be out perhaps even by the end of this year. Certainly the original one served as proof of concept that it can be effective. Lena, it's such a critical area. And thank you so much for going over the different ways we can mitigate risk in high-risk populations and the nuances of assessing that risk and talking with patients. We're about out of time on our podcast. Are there any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would say that this is yet another critical time in the pandemic, but perhaps for different reasons than before. Before, we talked about the danger of COVID to everyone. And I'm not discounting the fact that people could still be, could still get COVID and that individuals, some individuals may suffer severe consequences, even if they're generally healthy, or they could have long COVID from contracting COVID. All of that is certainly possible. But I think we also have to acknowledge that we're at this stage where COVID is particularly worrisome for a select group of individuals. Those are the individuals that we need to put, I believe, all of our resources toward. The fact that COVID isn't impacting really and changing the lives of the majority of Americans doesn't mean that we should take our eyes off the prize in terms of helping those particularly vulnerable individuals. And to me, it actually says the opposite, that now we have this group that we should focus our energies towards. And I'm very glad that that there are researchers, companies, scientists, academicians, et cetera, that are working to develop better therapeutics and preventive treatments for those particularly vulnerable people.
Critically important area. Dr. Lena Wen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Dr. Skolnick.
Let me add, approximately a week after the recording of this podcast, on January 26th, the FDA determined that Tixagavimab, Sulgavimab, is, quote, not currently authorized, unquote, for emergency use, EUA, for pre-exposure prophylaxis of COVID-19 in the U.S. due to sustained high frequency of circulating SARS-CoV-2 variants resistance to this monoclonal antibody exceeding 90%. The FDA indicated that it might consider reinstating this authorization for possible future use in case variants that are susceptible to the antibody combination become more prevalent. And for the National Association for Continuing Medical Education, NACE, I'm Dr. Neil Skolnick. This series has been supported by an educational grant from AstraZeneca, and thanks for joining.